if we want to overcome the darkness in our lives, the darkness that creeps in, the things that we struggle with, the things that are hard for us, we have to be willing to do something, to change something, to try something different.
And I'm convinced that the human spirit was not designed to simply maintain normal. Somewhere along the line, we forget that our job wasn't to maintain normal. Our job was to step into an unprecedented future where God continually presses us into what's next.
God will never ask you to respond to a call that doesn't already speak to the best part of you, the part of you that was designed for greatness, that deep down knows that there is something more.
Hey, and welcome to the Mosaic Pomona podcast. I hope that you enjoy this week's talk and want to invite you to join us live on Sundays at 10 a.m. at the Glasshouse Concert Hall in beautiful downtown Pomona. Or you can join the conversation at www.mosaicpomona.org. You can also download the Mosaic Pomona app on iTunes or Android and keep up with the conversation and community there. If you would like to financially support this podcast and the ongoing movement at Mosaic Pomona, visit us online at mosaicpomona.org/give or check out the giving option on the Mosaic app. Enjoy this week's talk. God, we celebrate your love and your hope and your joy and your freedom in this place, God. We thank you that there is hope, God, in every situation that we find ourselves in, God. And that's not just a cliche. It's a truth that you speak over us. And we ask today that your voice, your presence would be so close to us as we engage your scriptures, as we engage one another. Would you teach us to live in your presence in a way that transforms everything, God? Would you move us all closer to you, no matter where we're at in our journeying with you, whether we're skeptical of who you are, God, and not sure whether you are good or whether you exist at all, or whether we are close and you draw us closer, Father, I ask that you would continue to pursue us faster and harder. We thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it's been fun over the last few weeks just sharing with you some things that are on my heart personally as we've not been in a series. We'll start a series next week called Disciple. But I wanted to end our summer conversation in a passage in Hebrews chapter 11. If you have a copy of the scriptures, you can turn there. If you need a copy of the scriptures, just raise your hand. One of our team members would get you one. We love giving out Bibles. If you don't have one, just raise your hand. It's yours to keep take home. Hebrews 11 is an interesting chapter because have you ever gone through life and you get to places where you forget how, I'll just use the word lucky you've been, right? Or blessed, or how generous God has been with you, whatever language you want to use on that. I know I get there really easily. I forget really fast all the things that God has done for us. In fact, I find myself more often in the place of, God, where are you? And why don't you do anything rather than, God, thank you so much for all that you have done. It's easy for me to find myself there. And Hebrews 11 is one of those moments where the scriptures pause, and it's just an entire book or chapter dedicated to looking back on all of the things that God has done. It's kind of titled the Heroes Hall of Faith, because it's these men and women who have done incredible things as they acted in faith and seeing how God was faithful back to them as they stepped into that space. It's a powerful chapter to dive into, to realize how good God is and what it looks like to live by faith. And so I want to jump into kind of an obscure passage in Hebrews 11, verse 30, and talk through a specific moment where God shows up with his people. So Hebrews 11, 30 says this, "By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. And by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient." So we're going to pause there. Some of you may be going, what did we just read? Right? If you know the backstory, you know what we're talking about. But this is where we're going to pause this morning and take a look at this moment in the scriptures. Because engaging faith is a very personal thing. It's a me and God thing. In fact, no one gets to like inherit faith from someone else. There's not like a communal bestowing upon you of faith. It's a very personal thing. I come from a
a family of pastors. In fact, I'm the 9th generation of pastors, which means that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a pastor, and moving forward, here I am. And I have people all the time have this idea that somehow I have been given this deep faith that has been building for 9 generations, and I would love that to be the case. I have a legacy that's been passed on to me, but my faith had to be developed alone, by myself, in the trenches of life between me and God. And my faith is built the same way that your faith is built, individually, one-on-one, together. And that's how we develop when we're connected with God. But just because something's personal doesn't mean that it's also communal. Just because something's an individual process doesn't mean that it also doesn't belong to and is informed by a community around us. I remember the first time I was in Argentina, We were in this large gathering somewhere like this, and everyone had these big mugs. And I realized later on that they were filled with a tea called mate. And everyone had them. They just carried them around with them everywhere they went. And some people had them, some people didn't have them, but the majority of the people had one. But everyone had a spoon and a straw. It was like a spoon straw attached to it, and with a filter at the bottom. And the craziest thing that I observed in the Argentinian culture is you could go up to anyone with a mug and just stick your straw in their mate and drink. It was bizarre. I mean, people were just coming up to strangers, hey, can I have some of your mate? Yeah, no problem. And they would just share this communal drink. It was kind of disgusting to me, but it was completely acceptable in their culture. And I realized, oh, this is like this example of how something can be very personal and yet communal at the same time. See, because faith is an individual thing, and yet it is expressed and grown also in the context of community. And living by faith is no different. In fact, when you look at this moment where the writer of Hebrews is talking about this moment where the Israelites walked around this city of Jericho and the walls fell down, it actually doesn't mention anyone. It just says the army had faith. So there's nothing very personal about that. In fact, that's very communal. And then when it does get personal, they actually put Rahab the prostitute. Poor Rahab. She can't get away from that sting, right? That reputation. But when they actually do share who had faith in this context, they're referring to a prostitute in the middle of this. Which what I love is when we see in the book of Hebrews and all over the scriptures is that faith is more of a we thing than it is a me thing. It's more about us than it is specific individuals connecting to God. That there is a communal aspect that comes with this. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But we talk a lot about community at Mosaic. But have you ever felt like in the context of community that people are just holding you back? Come on, let's be honest, right? Let's just be honest. Have you ever just like, you've been in a group of people and you're just like, these people are holding me back. I could run so much faster, so much further if I just didn't have these people around me. Some of you are sitting next to them and you're like, these people, right? But we find ourselves there, right? We were on teams and we're like, if I just didn't have to deal with this team or this group of the team, then I could get so much more work done or I could go so much faster, even at work, right? If I didn't have to have all these group projects, then I could just do what I needed to do. If I didn't have to deal with my boss and my coworkers, I could just move so much further, faster. Even with our family at times, right? I mean, we love our family, but let's be honest. Doesn't it feel like at times my family is just weighing me down? Not you, honey. Love you. But I feel like at times people even feel that way with this movement called the church. That I can just move so much further, faster with my faith if I didn't have to deal with this thing called community in the church. That I could actually just do so much more and live so much more free if I could just get away from this movement known as the church. And let me tell you, it can be easier at first to just disconnect yourself in the context of faith community. But you will find yourself quickly isolated and slowing down and not able to outpace where a larger group can go. But I get this all the time. It's one of the reasons why I hate going to like trying to figure out lunch with a large group of people after church, after our gathering on Sunday. Because everyone just stands around. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? In my head, I'm just like, I'm just going to go to McDonald's because I don't care. I really don't care. But let's move. Standing here is a waste of time. It's why I refuse to go to Disneyland with a group of people. Because we will sit there standing for 40 minutes going, what do you want to do next? I don't know. What do you want to do next? And I'm just like, I don't care. Let's go home, ride the tram around all day, but let's not do this, right? Because it feels at times that the larger group can be cumbersome to this thing called movement or this thing called momentum or faith in this context. It feels like it's a hindrance. It seems like it'd be easier to travel alone. But the thing of the matter is that it seems like from what we read in the scripture and what I see from individuals is that God gives us each a measure of faith. That we all have the capacity to live by faith, to live a life filled with risk and purpose and passion, and have God intervene in miraculous ways and have your life turn into something beautifully supernatural that extends far beyond what you could ever do on your own. But I see that God gives some greater measures of faith than others. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed those people in life that just seem to believe more than you do? I hate it, right? Then there are people who just like seem to have greater faith and greater levels of belief and greater levels. And I'm like, how do you get there? How do you get to that place with those people? And it seems like we each have our own level of faith. Not to either elevate ourselves or to diminish ourselves, but that when we come together in community, we might actually be able to support one another. See, because there are people in my life who have had greater levels of faith, who have elevated my levels of faith because I've been around them, because they chose to connect their life to my life. I look at them and I'm like, you have no need for me in your life. If anything, I am the weight and the anchor to you moving forward. And yet they chose to hitch their wagon to mine and pulled me into greater levels of faith and understanding and belief. See, there's something that happens when we come together and say, I'm going to serve humanity with one another, that elevates everyone that finds themselves in their space so that no one is carrying a greater load than others in this context. And so I want to take a look at this moment where the Israelites find themselves in a rather interesting situation, marching around a city called Jericho. So if you turn with me to Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 1, this is the conversation that we find ourselves in Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 1. It says this: Now the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went in and no one came in. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its kings and its fighting men. Pause right there. See, this is what I love about following Jesus, and oftentimes what gets me really frustrated is because God makes statements about your current reality that aren't yet true as if they already are true. Because he's saying, look, at this city who has these mighty gates around them. It is a walled, fortified city, and the gates are closed because of you. No one's getting in and no one's getting out, and you are barred from getting inside of this city. And then the Lord says, see, like look out and see. He says, I have delivered Jericho into your hands along with its kings and its fighting men. Now, if I'm the Israelites, I'm going, I don't see this, right? Can you show me what you see here in the middle of this? See, what I love about Jesus is that he's constantly speaking out our future before it even happens. He's constantly speaking the future that he longs for us to step into now, as if it has already happened before we can even see it. See, because what he's not asking to do is say, look at the walls, see how they've fallen down, or look at the gates, see how I flung them open. He's saying, I want you to see at a deeper level. I want you to see at the level at which I see, because when I look at this city, I don't see a problem. I know you look at the city and see a problem. I know you look at the walls and see walls. When I look at this city, I see you delivered. That's what I see. See, God is constantly speaking into your present, the future that he's already created for you. If you would be willing to step into that future with him to create it. And this is where he calls the Israelites into. He says, march around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast of the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout, and then the walls of the city will collapse, and the army will go up, everyone straight in. So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant to the Lord, and have 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it. And he ordered the army, advance, march around the city with armed guards, going along the Ark, going ahead of the Ark of the Lord.
And when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. At this time, the trumpets were sounding, but Joshua had commanded the army, "Do not give a war cry. Do not raise your voice. Do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout. Then shout." So he had the ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the army of the Lord returned to the camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord, and the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets went forward, marching before the ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets, and the armed men went ahead of him and the rear guard following, and the ark of the Lord, while the trumpets kept sounding. So on the second day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did this for 6 days. On the seventh day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city seven times in the same manner, except on that day, they circled the city seven times. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." See, this is an odd military strategy, right? I mean, this is a really, really bizarre military strategy in the grand scheme of things. The thing is that the Israelites had already had a reputation that had gone out before them, and all of the nations around them understood that if you went up against the Israelites, you would lose. That if you went up against God's people, you are up against a God that is bigger than your God and your army that is stronger than your army. Even if you have more people, and even if you have more weapons, and even if you have more strength, your army will be defeated. And so the Israelites went with this reputation everywhere they went, that God was on their side, that he would pull for them in any battle they found themselves. And God says to the Israelites, "Take your priests and your musicians and go fight the battle," right? Take your priests and your musicians. He doesn't say, like, take your best warriors, the strongest men that you have, and make them ready to go out there and storm the gates. He doesn't say any of that. In fact, he flips the script and probably says the two people that you would not want to put on the front of the line, what are they going to do out there, like bugling and praying in front of the walls, right? This seems crazy in the context of this. But this is what they did. The same thing every single day. Went out with the Ark of the Covenant, shouting and or blowing their trumpets, singing out loud. And this is what they found themselves doing day after day after day after day. It says they do this for 6 days. Now, this was a critical and unique moment for the Israelites. In fact, it's one of the reasons why this story stands out among many other stories in the Old Testament, because God had been leading the Israelites through the wilderness to this place called the Promised Land. And a whole entire generation had died off by the time they get to this place in Jericho. Now, you don't have to know the scriptures. All you need to do is watch a movie with Charlton Heston to know that the main character of the Israelites being liberated from Pharaoh was who? Moses, right? Moses, Prince of Egypt, right? That's all you need to know, is that Moses was the man when it came to the Israelites. He was the guy who released them from this space, that he had set them free, and found themselves on their way to the Promised Land. And by this time, he is gone. And you have an entire generation of people who have no idea about Moses. All they have is stories about this old guy that died a while back. They don't have the same type of reputation or connection with Moses and the understanding and the pull that came with being in relationship with him. They had not known him. And here's the thing. All they had known were the amazing things that God had done in the history of Israel. That's all they had. They had memories from their parents that shared with them about the things that God had done in the past and the things that he had done. They had tasted and seen in the past about how he had delivered them, about how he had provided for them, about how he had given everything needed to supply their needs. But now they find themselves in a space where all they have is rumors of this God who does the miraculous. All they have is stories about how great God is and what he had done for them. In fact, if you read through the scriptures, One of the signs that God gave the Israelites to consecrate or to set aside their sons as men of God was to physically circumcise them. That was like an act that was saying, you are now set aside to be a part of God and in his spirit. And it said that the people had even forgotten to do that. That the fathers hadn't even done that practice. So you have a whole generation growing up who don't even know the practices of what it looks like to be even physically set apart in this, that Joshua had to go and do it because the fathers had forgotten all about this. And so you find yourself here in a group of people who all they had was stories from the past about what God had done and had forgotten about the power that he actually had over them. See, there's something that happens to the soul when your faith starts relying on stories from the past of how God had moved and when he did move and that time in the past when he did something rather than being present with him right now where he is doing and he is moving and he is shaping. There's something that happens to your soul when you start relying on things of the past and saying, oh yeah, I know God's faithful because 3 years ago he did this. Or 4 years ago he showed up like this. See, when the good old days become more attractive than what's currently taking place or where God's moving you into, you have a problem. Because you will begin to die. I can guarantee it. If you constantly are relying on what took place yesterday to step into this place, you will find yourself dead. And God, here in this moment, above everything else, was attempting to drive the Israelites back to their source, to find themselves once again connected here and now to the presence of God. And it shouldn't be a surprise that the weapon that God chose to drive them back to their choice was worship. It shouldn't be a surprise that he says, take the priests and the musicians and go worship. And this is how you will see God do a miracle. This is how you will see God do the miraculous in this space. Because here's the other crazy thing, is that up until now, they had been fed by this thing called manna, which literally means what is it? Because they didn't know what it was. And every morning they would wake up and there would be like food on the ground and quail just waiting for them to be eaten. I mean, could you imagine waking up in the morning and there's like a box filled with all your food? Some of you Amazon your food, so you know what that's like. But you know, there's just like food. You just wake up. There's everything I need. Don't have to go hunting for it. Don't have to do anything. It's already provided for me. And so they didn't even have manna left. And God was saying, I am driving you back to that source, and that source will be worship. See, I love that before this even happens, Joshua has this encounter with this angel. In fact, go to Joshua chapter 5, starting in verse 13, and it says this. If you just flip back one, it says, now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or for our enemies? If you have to ask that question, you're in a bad place, right? So, are you for us or for your enemies? Neither, he replied, which is not actually a good answer, right? But when there's this man standing above you with a sword asking who you're from, I'm from neither of you. But as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for my servant? And the commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And Joshua did so. See, here's the thing. Joshua stood in the presence of God himself, as the angel, the commander of the army of the Lord, the angel of the Lord, which is referred to as Jesus later on in the New Testament. And he's standing before him, and he doesn't even recognize him. This is how far they've gotten. He doesn't even recognize them in that space. He says, are you for us or against us? And he's like, I'm for neither of you. However, where you're standing right now currently is holy ground. And it is holy because you are now meeting me here and my presence is with you. See, anywhere that God steps into with you becomes holy ground. Anytime that your spirit connects to the spirit of God, it becomes holy ground and something happens. It's why he says, take off your shoes. And let's continue the story because it continues in Joshua 6:15 to see where he goes with this. So after they've blown their trumpets and they've done this, verse 15, on the seventh day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city seven times in the same manner, except on that day, they circled the city seven times. On the seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and irons are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury. And when the trumpet sounded, the army shouted at the sound of the trumpet, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the walls collapsed. So everyone charged straight in, and they took the city. They took the city in this moment. See, this is what takes place when you find yourself connecting to the presence of God in worship, hearing his voice, and acting in faith on it, is that things happen. See, what I love is that God shook the heart of Joshua first. And then he said, I'm going to take your priests and your musicians, and I'm going to shake the hearts of the people that are in your army. And then, on top of that, I will make the walls fall down as you worship me. And he's saying only God could possibly do this. He's saying, I'm going to show you something that is so profound that you are going to walk away going, what on earth just happened? We had this crazy encounter where we worshiped and walls fell down in the middle of us. See, I wonder for many of us how many of us have actually learned that our strength is found in the act of worship. Our strength is found in the act of connecting to a God and giving ourselves over to him. See, the fact of the matter is that we as human beings, we were designed to worship. That's part of our intrinsic design, is to lay ourselves before God and say, I give you everything. You see this all the time. I think this is why human beings flock towards large events, like sporting events or entertainment, where we cheer and we scream at the people that we want, the players that we're calling for, the actors that we long for, the bands that we long to hear, because there's something inside of us that longs to be together in a communal experience, giving ourselves over to something that we honor or that we love or that we want to give attention or energy to. See, this is what the human spirit was designed to, and our soul remembers that. It's why we try to recreate circumstances and situations where we find ourselves, and whether it's a sporting arena or in a theater or in a space like this, our souls remember that we were designed to come together to worship, and that you need this strength to move forward. See, worship doesn't actually mean singing. I know we think that. When we come together on Sunday mornings, we sing, and that's an act of worship. But the word worship actually means proskuneo. That's the Hebrew, that's the Greek word. It means to lay yourself down physically, everything before a king. When you came before a king, you would lay proskuneo, which means you would lay down, arms out, and say, I give you everything. You have the right to take whatever you want from me right now. I give my life to you. And this is the image that God gives us when we worship him, that we lay everything down. See, there's all kinds of ways to worship. But here's the thing. I guarantee you, if you can't make a fool of yourself singing here, it's going to be very difficult to find yourself worshiping anywhere else. Yeah. I guarantee you. Which is one of the reasons why we worship here, because this is a collective gathering space where we invite the presence of God to be with us and move with us and to shape us. It's a practice ground, if you will, for the rest of our week of stepping out and experiencing this thing called worship. I don't know about you, but oftentimes where I need worship the most is when life feels out of control. And oftentimes when life feels out of control, worship is the last place that I go to. Have you noticed that to be true for you? Like here, the Israelites found themselves in a space where they were out of control. They had no possibility on their own to break through these walls. It was just a fact. They were not going to get through them. And so they found themselves in a space of out of control. Now, when I find myself in a space in life where I feel out of control, whether it's my own thoughts or my behavior or my attitude or whatever it may be, or circumstances that I find myself in, when I find myself there, my natural response is not to worship, but to take control back. Have you found that to be true? Like, I just want to get as much control as I can. If I can't control that, I will control everything else in my life because I'm just going to try to figure out how to gain whatever control I can have back. So essentially, what I start doing is beating at the walls of Jericho, right? Whatever circumstances you find yourself in that are out of control, whether it's your finances or your marriage or your relationships or your career, we just start beating at the wall, right? Ah! Trying to take control back, getting angry at the wall that's in front of us. And so we find ourselves attempting to beat down the wall on our own, and it actually only creates more fear, anxiety, and worry. Have you noticed that? Because as we're out there beating on the walls of our circumstances and the things that feel impossible and the things that feel out of control, the more and more we beat on them, the more and more out of control we feel. Because we recognize there is no hope, there is no future, there is no possibility here in just beating at the walls of Jericho. What I love about worship is a declaration saying, I am out of control. It's just a declaration. It's a declaration saying, I have no possibility here. That there is no hope in my own hands here to make these walls fall down. There is no way in my own hands that I can change this attitude in this heart, or that attitude of that heart, or this circumstance that I find myself in, or the finances that I'm in over here. There's just no possibility. I am out of control. What I need is a God to intervene in the middle of that. That the walls will never go down if I just keep beating them. I will just become more and more bloody if I do that. So rather than trying to take more control, I choose to worship. I choose to say, I am out of control in here. See, what the Israelites needed in this moment was a moment of awe and wonder. See, that's what God is attempting to do with the circumstances that feel out of control in your life. He is attempting to create a context to bring awe and wonder into your life where it is filled with anxiety, fear, and hopelessness right now. That's what he's attempting to do. And see, this is one of those what moments for the Israelites where they look back on this moment and they go, what was that? It's why years later in Hebrews they mention this moment, because it was this moment that they worshiped in faith in light of the words that God had spoken over them, and everything changed. This is what takes place. See, I know that there are walls in your life because I know that there are walls in my life. Because I know that there are a lot walls in the lives of all of humanity. Those places that at times feel hopeless or overwhelming or out of control, or we've just settled like, hey, this is never gonna change, so I'm never gonna really deal with it, and I'm not gonna even attempt to look at it again. I'm not even gonna beat at it anymore because they feel so overwhelming. I'm not even gonna step in there. See, but some of you need to stop beating on the walls, bloodying yourself up. Some of you need to remove yourself out of the apathy that has come from being overwhelmed by the walls. And some of you just need to get messy. See, because that's what the Israelites did here. Yeah. This was messy. This was like, I don't know if this is gonna work, but we're gonna walk around blowing trumpets and screaming, right? We're gonna make a fool of ourselves in an attempt to connect to God. If it means me standing up and screaming and shouting, I will do that, because that's what God has spoken into my life here in this moment. And I love that they bring this Ark of the Covenant, this Ark of the Lord around with them, this symbol of God's presence and this symbol of worship everywhere they went. It was the promise of the presence of the Lord. See, God had showed up all through this journey with the Israelites. He had shown up in a pillar of fire at night that guided them. He showed up in a pillar of cloud during the day that could lead them around through the wilderness. He constantly showed up in his presence. And the Ark of the Covenant was a symbol promising that God's presence would be with them. And it's why they took that Ark everywhere that they went, especially when they were walking around this wall. See, one of the worst places that you can find yourself in life, it's not necessarily in hopelessness or darkness, not even in sin. One of the worst places that you can find yourself is disconnected from the presence of God. Because as long as you're connected to the presence of God, he can transform anything. He can transform sin, hopelessness, brokenness. He can do the unthinkable. He can make all things new in the middle of that. See, this is why when Joshua found himself with the angel, he said, take off your shoes, because God's presence was there, and that made it holy ground. It was sacred because God and man were meeting together. If you've been a part of our community, specifically when I've been leading our community, you'll know that I am no respecter of buildings. In fact, most of you don't know our history, but we were in Chino for many years, and we had this god-awful monstrosity of a facility. And I remember we had this giant auditorium, and above it outside said, Worship Center. And I hated it. I absolutely hated it because I was like, this is a warehouse. Sometimes it's a worship center when people are worshiping in it, but other than that, it's just a warehouse. And I hate the phraseology. In fact, the day that I took over as pastor, I hired someone to go scrape those words off the wall. Because I was like, this is not a worship center. This is a building that is used for worship at times when God and man meet here. But the rest of the week, God doesn't dwell in a warehouse in Chino, right? It's why I don't even like using the word sanctuary when we talk about a place where we gather together, because it's not like God lives in a space like the glass house, right? That would be awesome, but he doesn't, right? There's all kinds of other spirits that live in here during the week, but this is not God's dwelling place. But you know, the crazy thing is that when we come to a club like this, that no matter what spirits have been worshiped in here during the week, that this becomes holy ground because God meets us here. That's the most powerful thing. That's the most profound thing, is that this becomes holy ground because we have met here in this place. And everywhere that you step foot, when you are connected to the Spirit of God in the context of community, becomes holy ground. Which is why it's always like strange to me when people who have interacted with the Spirit of God talk about going to gather together like this in the context of like a Sunday or a C3 group as like one option among many. As if like it was like, well, I might go to Starbucks and I might go be in the presence of the creator of the universe. Right? As if there was even an option in the connection between the two, because there is something profound that happens when we come together and we lift our voices and we as a people say we are one and we will make this holy ground. See, when you worship, everywhere you go is sacred space. When you walk with God, and then you can access him and he will begin speaking to you on how to break down your walls. See, that's the crazy thing. And I think sometimes I'm a little crazy in having faith that if I just get people close enough to Jesus, if you move close enough to Jesus, he will actually begin telling you the strategy to break down your walls. And guess what? I don't always know what that strategy is, because if it was up to me, I would not have told the Israelites, get your trumpets out and start walking around, right? I would have said, let's get some pickaxes and let's get some dynamite, whatever it may be. But God will begin speaking to you how to break down your walls specifically when you enter his presence through worship. And in closing, I love that Rahab, the prostitute, is the one who gets all the credit in this context other than God. That this is who's mentioned. See, because Rahab was a prostitute in the city, and she was the only one that would hide the spies from God's army when they came into the city to find out how they were going to infiltrate the city. And she was blessed because she was the one person who was hospitable to the men who were carrying the presence of God. See, here's what I love, is we want to make Joshua the hero in this moment, right? Like God spoke to Joshua, and he is a hero in this moment. Don't worry, he gets his credit in there. But the thing is, in the scriptures, in any moment, the hero becomes the person who hears God's voice and follows. That's who becomes the hero. Wow. That's all it takes. That's all it takes to become the victor in the story, is the person who's probably least expected, the prostitute on the wall, right? Of all the people who would be chosen to be the one who got the credit in this moment for faith, was Rahab here in this moment. Because worshiping aligns you with the mission of God. You are one choice away from being a new creation. That's the thing. Rahab was just one choice away. And when those spies came in, she could have said, no, that's like not my thing. But in that instant, she said, you're different. Come in, I will support you. I will protect you. I will take care of you. And because of that, not only is her name listed in Hebrews as one of the greats of the faith, but her bloodline actually flows into the bloodline of Jesus. See, because if you turn to Matthew chapter 1, starting in verse 5, when you look through all of the people that are listed in the genealogy of Jesus, Matthew chapter 1, verse starting in verse 1, it says, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Solomon, Solomon the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, and it goes on and on and on. See, Rahab goes on to be in the very bloodline of a Savior. Because everything transformed because she worshiped and lived in faith. See, no matter what has happened, God can realign it with his purposes when we step into this space of worship. See, when we say it's all about God and our worshiping him, the beautiful thing is that Rahab was saved out of Jericho, but then she was saved into Israel. She was saved out of her brokenness and saved into nobility. She was saved out of her sin and hopelessness, and she was saved into a high elevated space. See, God just isn't interested in taking you out of your junk. He's actually interested in elevating you into something far more profound than you were when you started. See, I wonder for how many of us are looking for God and we know that there's something more. We know that there's like this more available to us than we could ever ask or imagine. And see, what I love is that we love God, but we love people in the context of community as the Israelites did. That there's this power that comes with this, that you never have to journey alone. And then when you journey together in the context of a community that worships together, there's something that happens. There's something that moves inside of us. He moves us to this journey beyond what we can see and imagine. And he moves us into the unthinkable. He is interested in taking your walls and breaking them down, destroying them to you to step into something new. But it starts with worship. It starts with a space of worship. I want us to stand together. Would you do that with me? We're gonna bring the lights down. And I want us to, we're gonna sing this song that we sang earlier, all right? And I want us just to take a few moments, just a little bit of time. I know some of you are thinking, oh, it's time to go, I gotta go, whatever. Just pause for a moment. And I want us to sing this song as we just declare spirit break out and worship together. I want you to lay everything aside. If you need to just look a fool, if you need to cry out to God, if you need to yell even over your circumstances, this is your space. But we're gonna just declare that heaven's gonna meet earth and that we can meet his presence here in this space. So I'm gonna have the band lead us and let's just take a moment and let's worship together.
Thanks for listening to this week's talk. Join us next week for a new conversation or download the Mosaic Pomona app to continue interacting with the Mosaic Pomona community. Thanks and have a great week.